Hey listeners, welcome back to our podcast, The Climate Stand with The Final Stand. I, Dithi, am here today with board member Isha, and we're going to be interviewing Professor Sivan. Professor Sivan Prasad is currently the Assistant Dean and Professor at JSES, that is the Jindal School of Environmental Sustainability. He's completed his undergraduate studies from the University of India and his master's from the University of Cambridge. He's practiced law across 5 countries, including India, Sri Lanka, England, Scotland, and Singapore, and has done extensive research in the fields of biodiversity conservation and animal rights. Today, our conversation will be on the topic of animal rights and will be led by our TFS's board member, Isha.
So, hi, everyone, and hello, Professor. It's great to have you here. My first question to you is, you know, why should anybody really care about animal rights or animal welfare? You know, because a lot of people say that meat eating is a personal preference, and moreover, it's something that isn't it supposed to be natural?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the starting point is to assume, and I think this is a rather safe assumption, that most people want to behave in a manner that's ethical. If someone says they don't wish to behave ethically, then that person immediately goes out the window. But if you wish to behave ethically, then there really is very little excuse to be treating animals in a manner that causes suffering. And the idea is very simple. The term that's used for it is speciesism. So let me just try and explain that in very simple terms. The idea is that if you are treating any individual, whether that individual is of another species or another animal, differently, then that difference in treatment must be justified the same way you would need to justify a difference in treatment among human beings. So for example, if someone were to come up and say tomorrow that women should not be permitted to access educational institutions, you would immediately argue that the difference in treatment between men and women vis-a-vis access to education is irrational.
Right.
In other words, there is no rational or logical basis on which you should deny or you ought to deny women access to education. Now, the same principle and logic can also be applied to the treatment of animals. Most human beings, apart from perhaps sadomasochists, would probably claim for themselves a right not to be tortured. Now, the question is, should animals deserve the same treatment? To justify differential treatment against animals, you would need to show why there is a rational reason that you can treat animals differently to the way you're treating other human beings. And there seems to be no rational explanation for why you must do so. Many animals are rational. Many animals are sentient and can feel and suffer pain. If humans meet these criterions as well, then there really is no reason why you ought to treat animals differently. When you do start to treat them differently, you are discriminating against them, the same way you would be discriminating against other human beings if you treated them differently without rational reason. Now, this is plainly unethical, unjustifiable, and discriminatory. And that's the most simple reason why we ought to exercise concern over our treatment of animals. Now, I should caveat this by saying that it does get a little more complicated when you start introducing questions like, what if the killing was pain-free, or what if the animals aren't sentient? But the basic point still stands, which is that if we wish to be treated with respect, without pain, without torture, then we must also treat other individuals, including animals, that feel and experience the same amount of pain in the same way, if we wish to claim that we are ethical beings.
That's very beautifully put, Professor. And basing on your answer, veganism is becoming becoming widespread, and it's a lifestyle where you try to live without any animal cruelty. So do you think that is the only morally acceptable path?
Yeah, perhaps before I answer that, Dithi, I should also just answer the last part of Isha's question, which is the argument that it is natural to eat meat. Now, nature, the general rule is that nature permits and culture forbids. Humans are different from animals because we apply our minds, we apply our moral and ethical senses to distinguish ourselves from pure nature. Nature allows everything. Nature allows sexual assault. Nature allows cannibalism. Nature allows everything. Anything that you can do in this world is intrinsically possible by nature. That is not and never has been a justification to do anything we want. So the argument that we should do something just because nature permits it or that it's so-called natural is a complete non-starter from all perspectives. So that should immediately be put aside. Now, moving on to Deepi's question, veganism is a slightly more complicated question. The popular belief amongst many animal welfare advocates is that veganism is the only option if you wish to treat animals with respect. Now, the reality is that the ethics on this is rather complicated and depends on which branch of ethical theory you subscribe to. We must all remember that there is no one ethical theory which is sacrosanct, inviolable, and universally true. There simply is no such theory in ethics in any department. So with animal welfare and animal rights, we have a number of theories, but the two main theories are probably Peter Singer's utilitarianism and Tom Reagan's rights-based approach. A veganist would probably subscribe to Tom Reagan's approach, which requires intrinsic value that animals possess to be respected. Now, I won't go into it too much, but the basic idea is that animals are subjects of life because they experience emotions, they have desires, they can feel pain. And all of this gives them intrinsic value, which means that we cannot justify violating their rights for the benefit of something extrinsic. So we can't say we are going to get pleasure from eating meat, therefore we can kill you. That would be a violation of the respect principle. So according to Reagan, any animal that is the subject of a life has to be treated with respect, which means you cannot kill them. That is the basic position. And that would be a strongly vegan position. On the other hand, Peter Singer is a utilitarianist. And for utilitarianists, it's not so much the individual that matters, but society as a whole. And you can justify actions based on the net impact they have on society. So if the overall welfare of society is improved by a certain act, then you can do it. And how does that apply to animals? Well, Peter Singer says that animal farming as currently practiced is an evil, is not justified by utilitarianism because the pain that animals suffer in being reared and being killed the way they are far outweighs any possible benefit to human beings that can accrue. However, he says, if it were possible to raise animals in a humane manner with their welfare adequately accounted for and also kill them in a manner that does not cause pain, then theoretically it would be justifiable to eat meat. So if you take that line to its logical conclusion, veganism isn't the only option available for those who wish to care about animal welfare.
Thank you, Professor. That was very well explained and very enlightening too. Now, I would like to take the conversation bring it home. And so India is home to several religious traditions that advocate for nonviolence, and they also advocate for compassion towards animals. But in your experience, do you think the spirit actually translates to how animals are treated in the country?
Unfortunately not. I think if the core esoteric spiritual practices that religions of India prescribe were followed, we not only would live in a society which has far less amounts of animal cruelty, but we would also live in a much more harmonious and peaceful and respectful society. The unfortunate truth is that religion has been used for millennia as not just a tool of spiritual instruction, which arguably it was set out to be, but also as a medium of social and political control. To that extent, the spiritual teachings, the core essence of many of these religions have been lost or are only practiced by very few people. If we do look at the traditions that we have in India, whether that's Hinduism in inverted commas, Jainism, or even Islam, you will see that this idea of not causing harm or suffering is core to all of these religions. Even halal, which is a practice that is very often criticized around the world, the essence of halal is to not cause harm or unnecessary suffering to the animal. Jainism, in contrast, has a complete ban on any form of meat eating, following the principle of ahimsa, which is also a principle that we find in the Hindu tradition. But again, the reality is that religion is not seen for all of these ends. If you look at India at the moment, religion is being used as a tool to divide society, as a political token. And so long as that continues, I'm afraid these core values that have the potential to change our relationship with animals and other human beings will simply remain in the old spiritual texts, gathering up dust. So that's rather unfortunate.
So Professor, while we're talking about India and we look at this in the legal sense and animal rights, how would you evaluate the laws and principles governing animal rights in India?
Well, the laws and principles governing animal welfare and rights in India aren't too bad. If you look through them, there are a number of acts, but broadly you have the Prevention of Cruelty Act 1960, you have an act called the Breeding of and Experiments on Animals Act, you have regulations, food and safety standards regulations, so you have a bunch of laws. I don't really need to go through all of them. But the laws, if you look at them, aren't terrible in themselves. I just like to read out, for example, one of the rules that are found in the food and safety regulations. It, for example, says the resting ground in slaughterhouses shall have overhead protective shelters. It also says that animals, when they are transported, shall be accompanied by an attendant, and that attendant should carry a first aid kit. So you can see we have fairly advanced and empathetic laws on animal rights and animal welfare. India is the first country in South Asia, for example, to ban cosmetic testing. Now, mind you, we still accept testing for drug purposes. But the basic point I'm trying to make is that our laws aren't terrible. Yes, our penalties are in many places pathetic. I think the penalty under the Prevention of Cruelty Act for causing unnecessary suffering is something like 10 to 25 rupees, which is going to deter absolutely nobody. Okay. But the larger problem isn't the laws. The laws are okay. If we implement what we already have, that would be a big, big step. The problem is lack of implementation. But more broadly, the problem is that law isn't as effective as changing behavior as we think it is.
So, Professor, since implementation is a problem, would strengthening these laws improve animal welfare, and what other approaches should we be looking at?
Well, strengthening the laws, I assume you mean making the laws tighter. Like I said just a minute ago, we don't need to make these laws any tighter if we can't already implement what we have. So I think the first step is to start implementing what we've already got. If you implement the food and safety standard regulations and require all slaughterhouses to stun animals, if you require transport in hygienic, safe conditions, that would be a big step. Now, the problem is that animal welfare isn't big on the political agenda. So there's only one way to fix it, which is to increase the political capital that is associated with animal welfare. It is only when the electorate and voters and a large segment of the population starts to care about this subject, only then will politicians also start to think about this subject. So if I could borrow a phrase from popular book by Mark Jacquard, the answer is that politics is the solution. It's not law. Enforcing any of this judicially, going for public litigations, none of that will work unless there is political will to implement and take these regulations that we already have further. So we must improve the political visibility of these issues.
Right, well said. So Professor, my final question to you is, how can Indian cities be made more inclusive and friendly for all kinds of fauna, you know, dogs, cats, birds, and the various kind of animals and birds that we see in an urban setting?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that, and this is related to the last question, the first thing we need to do is improve people's awareness about animals. We need to sensitize individuals to the idea that this planet is not just our planet, but a planet that we share with other beings. that have an equal right to this planet. And this must start at an early age. This must start in school, where kids are taught to have empathy towards the creatures that we share this planet with. Only then will any of these ideas that we're talking about start to take hold. The other related point is development. It is true that human beings do not think beyond themselves unless they are first comfortable. That may sound cynical, but I think it's largely true. So long as India continues to be a country in which a large proportion of individuals are struggling to meet their ends, we cannot expect them to start thinking about issues like animal welfare. So development has to go hand in hand with what we're trying to advocate here. And unless that happens, this is never going to feature on the agenda. Now, so far as how can we make our urban areas more hospitable to biodiversity? I'm using the word biodiversity because there are lots of animals, lots of species that we want to make urban areas friendly for. It's not just about dogs and cats. Dogs and cats have it much better than most animals.
Right.
But the first thing we probably want to do from a biodiversity perspective is ensure that there are still spaces, habitats available for biodiversity, whether these come in the form of natural parks, biodiversity parks, or simply designating certain areas of wilderness outside the city. This will go a great way towards ensuring that these human-modified landscapes, that's what we call them, human-modified landscapes, have space where biodiversity can actually rest. After that, it's a question of improving connectivity. So if there are birds, for example, migrating through an urban area, they should have a pathway, some green corridors or channels through which they can pass. And in these areas where you have some wilderness, you really want to restrict the movement of vehicles. You want to restrict pet animals from coming in. In essence, you're trying to maintain some bit of reserve for biodiversity, even in these urban areas. Stray dogs, stray cats are a slightly different issue. We wouldn't usually group them in the same category as wild animals like birds. Stray dogs and cats, again, completely different set of interventions, probably. They lead rather miserable lives in most cases, but I think it's with them, it's about spraying and neutering them where we can. Their proliferation is only leading to their own harm. So controlling population, I think, probably on balance, is a good idea. Second, improving avenues for medical care whenever these animals are injured, and creating shelters where they can rest will probably also limit the number of casualties that they face. But this is largely the realm of urban design. We need to work in tandem with the corporation, once again, local politicians, to design such biodiversity and pet-friendly spaces.
Great. Thank you so much, Professor. It was lovely talking to you. I'm sure Deethi and I both learned a lot. And hopefully, in the coming future, we'd love to have you back. And thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Isha. Thanks, Deethi. Pleasure.